Okay. Well, as a matter of fact, I do have something for you to write. But this time, it's a fill-in-the-blank. How about that? All right. So instead of one of these open-ended questions, this time the editor would say, "Yay! Wow! Okay. Thank God, this is not an open-ended question." She said, "No." Then what is it? And can I just say, I see just the look of anticipation in all of your faces. Okay. All right. Fill in the blank. Complete this sentence. I'm tempted to call it a day in ministry when blank. And call it a day means I'm out. You know, like, I'm tempted to call it a day in ministry when fill in the blank. Calling it a day means basically permanent vacation. You know, the sign is on the door. On vacation. Permanently. I'm tempted to call it a day in ministry when. All right, time's up. So, who from this side to my right would like to go first? When I run into one more conflict. Okay, all right.
Unfruitful. Someone or something I've invested in fails.
Ah, when someone or something I've invested in fails. Okay.
I die.
When I die. Okay. All right. Yes, that's like the answer we should have. Okay. Right. Anyone else?
When there doesn't seem to be much response.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Well, the reason I put it, I wanted to ask that question is because this session is about maintaining vision amid hard truths. In fact, if we stay at it long enough, we will all have our moments of frustration. And it may seem like we're spinning our wheels, going backwards perhaps. If you've ever been driving and you've gotten your car stuck in the mud, sometimes you think, okay, I'm going to get out of this. But of course, spinning your wheels sometimes just makes you go deeper where you are, rather than any forward momentum or backward momentum. Or if you're trying to, if you're trying to dig your car out of the snow. And, or if you think, I'll bet I can drive through those 5 or 6 inches of snow across that parking lot that hasn't been plowed yet. And then you think, no problem, even though I'm not driving an SUV. And then you start driving, and all of a sudden you're like, hey, how come I don't have the forward momentum that I thought I was going to have? And it's, right? With no one around. Not fun. Not fun. Well, this is something that attends ministry. And I sometimes wonder if because of ways that there is, I think, a kind of success industry, about what goes on with ministry. In other words, what sells books? What helps promote conferences? Well, ministry success. There was a conference I did hear about once. It was called like the Pastor Fail Conference. right? And it was about all the pastors who wanted to talk about, you know, how they, you know, how they had failed or flamed out, etc. But it was like limited to 30 people, so I imagine it was probably. But I think part of the reason was because they wanted it to be, you know, fairly intense, I think. But the point I'm making, I guess, is that we get our expectations shaped by certain things. And it might be even interesting to consider, I mean, how do our expectations get shaped by how we define what a Christian is, how we define what mission is? And if we define those things in ways where there's such a victory narrative that when we aren't immediately experiencing what we think we should be experiencing in ministry, then what we want to do is, you know, pack up and go on permanent vacation, right? Hang out the sign, say, that's it, I'm done. Well, to kind of pick up where we were in the last session, the problems that I was talking about are great problems that make people want to just check out. It's a play on words, but, you know, when we talk about things with race and ethnicity, you know, it's a race that won't come to an end. A race that, it's like, when's this all going to wrap up? When can we tie this up in a bow and no longer have to deal with all of these frustrations? Where we see certain social realities, where we see misunderstandings that happen between people, where we see anger, where we see protests. You know, I mean, I would like to see, for example, I would like to not see right now on Facebook another post about being active in Ferguson. I would like to see someone saying, as I saw a friend of mine just say, someone noting, say, well, you know, when we talk about the Ebola scare and that the Ebola scare is related to Africa, you know, a friend of mine said, finally an article that talks about the subtext of race with the Ebola scare. You know, because the Ebola scare isn't happening in Bulgaria. Okay? Even though Bulgaria is off the map for most of us. But it's not happening there. But what if the Ebola scare was happening in Bulgaria instead of in Western Africa? Northwestern Africa. What might the difference be? It's interesting to consider if it was in Bulgaria, in Eastern Europe. Because, by the way, parts of Eastern Europe are like being in the medieval era. Right? You know, when we talk about development, you know, we're always thinking about like places. We'll try thinking about Eastern Europe. Okay, parts of Eastern Europe. I mean, it's not so nice. Romania, Bulgaria, etc. You know, but what if that was the case? What might be different about it? But the point is I'm making is that I keep seeing people bringing up things about protests. People continuing to say over and over again how exasperated they are about, you know, stories about why our society doesn't care about darker people. Now, these aren't the only stories that I see, but they're some of the stories that I see. And I think part of what I also see articulated by some of my friends is their frustration with the fact that, in some ways, that things aren't changing, and another level, that they have low expectations of change. And they're kind of just crying out about how bad things are. So, I mean, you know, people keep putting stories out there. So, here's what complicates it when it comes to the race ethnicity thing. It's not always easy to tell when it's about race and when it's about something else. Right? So, using Ferguson again as an example, was Mike Brown shot because he was black? Well, probably not. But Officer Darren Wilson is white. Mike Brown was black. And what? And it, you know, and there was some altercation that led to him being shot, unarmed, etc. But why is there people saying, well, is it about race or isn't it about race? Well, because while the incident itself may not be explicitly motivated by race, it's framed by a history of police and minority interactions in Ferguson, Missouri, which, by the way, Ferguson, Missouri isn't, you know, some, you know, low income area. It's actually a middle class area. And a friend of mine who lives in St. Louis tells me this, it was actually as being kind of a progressive, you know, type of city. So, but there's this history of the for minorities, the police are not thought of in the frame of to protect and serve, you know, but to sort of identify and harass. I mean, that's what's thought of. And it's into that cauldron that the Mike Brown incident happens. So people say, well, it's at the end of the day about race because that's what the subtext, the context of the incident. So irrespective of why, you know, the particulars of it, it's framed that way. So, I mean, how do you talk about those things and understand those things in their proper complexity? And when do you say, well, actually, here's why race is definitely a part of it, or here's where race isn't a part of it? How do you do that? And how do you do that and keep the temperature low? It's very hard to do. It's very hard to do. And because these things happen, and because of the ways that the stories tend to get told in situations like what happens in Ferguson, many people get frustrated. Another frustration sometimes has happened is what happens when people try to have integrated churches. There's a former colleague who her dissertation was about basically like two failed integrated churches. So, and of course, everyone's excited about trying to have these integrated churches. There's only one problem. People actually had to, like, live together. And in living together, there were certain cross-cultural dimensions that just didn't work out so well. So eventually they had to, you know, call it a day. And there are people who sometimes think, you know, the best thing is for us to sort of peacefully coexist together. I'm not one of those people who actually believes that, but there are people who think that. In fact, the very first publication that I have, it was called When Will There Be Room in the Inn, about minorities and evangelical leadership development. Because I was wondering about why there weren't lots of minorities at evangelical institutions in terms of students or professors. I remember talking to J. Robertson McQuilkin, who had been president of Columbia Bible College and Seminary. Which he had informed me that initially when they integrated the school, like a board member left, all these kinds of things. But one of the things that he said in thinking about sort of the history of it all, he goes, you know, sometimes I just think we should just like try to find a way to coexist. Well, what kind of response is we should just find a way to coexist? To me, that's A pragmatic response to the inability to negotiate a range of frustrating circumstances that attend people who are different from each other trying to live together as a congregation. The reason that I think that that's not always or most of the time the way to go is because I think what one of the concerns is that people say, well, you know what? People get to a point where they're just tired of trying to do the work of having each other understand each other's ways of doing things. Ways of thinking about leadership, ways of thinking about the structure of a service, ways of thinking about music, ways of thinking about what your priorities are in mission, etc., etc., etc. And rather than trying to think through how one can do this together, people decide, okay, that's it, I'm out. My very first experience at Geneva College was in 1992. I went to a conference here. It was about African American evangelicalism. And there were people there, some of whom had been involved in church plants like this. There was one person in particular had been involved in a church that apparently had been like a very exciting church to be a part of in the 70s. And then it just blew up. Because the African-American pastor wanted to have more social action of a certain kind, and the other pastor didn't, and it just, they're like, that's it, you know, we can't be together anymore. Now, they reconciled before one of them died, but you know, it's a tragedy that happened. But why does that happen? Well, because the frustrations are real. And in the face of frustrations, the temptation is to just, when it comes to these kinds of issues, to just say, I think we need to take a permanent time out. Permanently, you know, just go to our corners. I'll take my toys and go home, and you take your toys and go home. And that's it. And I think that is a mistake. So, and here's, I guess, one of the reasons why I think that's a mistake. If people just get their toys and go home, they actually wind up being part of what turns out to be a conspiracy of silence about all of this. There are lots of ways that there can be a conspiracy of silence about that. One way for there to be a conspiracy of silence is just to refuse to acknowledge that there's anything to discuss. There's no problem with race. What are you talking about? Laws have been passed. People just need to work it out and, you know, appreciate the fact that we're freedom. This is America. I don't know why anybody thinks that, you know, this isn't the greatest country in the world. I mean, aren't you a patriot or aren't you? So, you know, refusing to acknowledge or pretending to acknowledge or pretending that there isn't anything to discuss. That's one dimension of it. But I think the other way is kind of like having paralyzed vocal cords. In other words, I'm not going to talk about this because of my own sense of inadequacy for the task, because I want to avoid further conflicts, or maybe just because of fear of what happens when the temperature just goes up. When you think, you know, if you think about the, like sometimes in animation, if the temperature goes up, like the thermometer goes up, and when it gets to the bulb at the top, it explodes. That kind of thing is what's going to always happen if we are dealing with these kinds of issues. And the thing is that if the approach then is saying, you know, I just don't think I have anything to say, or it's really, I don't want to say anything because I think, you know, an explosion is going to happen, then what we wind up doing is basically leaving things as they are and saying nothing about them and talking about all kinds of things except those things. and whether it's deciding to take your toys and go home, you know, in the case of certain integrated church plants, or whether it's whether you even talk about how Christians should think and act when it comes to these racial and ethnic issues, it winds up just being a conspiracy of silence. And to me, that conspiracy of silence needs to end, and that conspiracy of silence is not an option if we take our mission seriously. If we take our mission seriously, how can we do that? Because then the question, my question is, who else is going to do it? You know, when people want to complain about like what liberals are doing, et cetera, et cetera, what I want to say is, show me what your solution is. Show me what your plan is. Show me what your language is. And your language needs to be something other than people just need to know how to act as particular kinds of individuals. Because it's not just about people acting as particular kinds of individuals. That's a single dimension of it. But last time I checked, people live in social contexts. And there's lots of complexities to social context. There's political dimensions, educational dimensions, legal dimensions, medical dimensions, business dimensions. All those types of things you have to be concerned about. We can't pretend that we don't have to look at those problems. We have to do the long gaze, our own long take, rather than saying, no, 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 I'm not going to look at it. No, we have to look at it, and then we have to start thinking about how we act as courageous people in the face of difficult things. That's what we have to do. If we wind up being participants in the conspiracy of silence, we have to ask this. If I'm participating in the conspiracy of silence, what does that say about my expectations about Christian mission? What does it say about what I think the priorities of Christian mission are, or what they aren't, or what they should or should not be? What does it say about that? What does it say about our character as a people? Those kinds of things, those kinds of questions we have to ask ourselves. But what we can't do, in my view, is check out. Checking out is, at the end of the day, a coward's way out. Or, to make it stronger, a sinful way out. So what do we do? Well, first thing I think we need to do is be incredibly truthful about how hard, difficult, and frustrating it is. And one of the ways that we, as a practice, can actively encounter and engage that difficulty and that frustration is by the practice of lament. And the reason I think that's important is, well, here's one reason why. Because if you read the Old Testament, you read the Psalms or the Book of Lamentations, I mean, you see lots of statements about just how bad things are. You know, whether it's a complaint to God or whether it's articulations of mourning and grief about how horrible things are. I remember once reading the Book of Lamentations, just before I really understood what it was about, and I just kept thinking to myself, you know, this is just one downer of a book. You know, hello, it's a lamentation, right? I know. You might think, newsflash, do you know what a lamentation is? Well, then I didn't. I do now. Because the fact of the matter is this. Local stories, national stories, global stories will overwhelm us. You don't have to look hard. You don't have to search for long to find enough stories where you feel like you're just kind of under an avalanche of downers. Where you think, why, you know, I just need to go stick my head in the sand. Because I just can't deal with another story about how horrible this world is, about how bad people act, about how difficult the circumstances are. I mean, think about this. What does it mean to be hopeful about Syria right now? A story where, last time I checked, there aren't really any good guys. Right? They're just, it's just how bad is group A, B, C, D, or E, from Assad to others. Well, that's a difficult circumstance. Well, so is the option then. So what should Christians think about Syria? You know, Lord, they should get the Death Star treatment. I mean, is that what we think? Well, I don't think so. Right? But boy, is it frustrating. But we need to articulate our frustration, our complaint, our distress, our inadequacy, our fear to God. Be honest about it. Fiercely tell the truth about it. Don't pretend. Don't pretend. I think we need to at least practice lament regularly, not because we're hopeless, but because we're related to the one true God. And because we can relate to the one true God authentically. As if, you know, we claim, God, you're omniscient. Yeah, sometimes I think the way we relate to God, like God really isn't. Well, God, you don't really know how frustrated I am with the fact that the world just doesn't work out so well right now. So I'm not going to say anything to you about how frustrated I am about how the world doesn't work out so well right now. Well, no, we should. We should. Whether you're thinking about Syria, whether you're thinking about Ferguson, whether you're thinking about what just happened in Washington, we need to go to God with our laments about these things. Telling the truth about these stubborn ways that the world operates in a broken and unjust way. So that's the first thing. Yeah, that's what I mean. You're not silent if you're practicing lament. You're talking to God. That's one dimension of it. The second dimension is tied to this, that we are inspired by the way we look at the end of the story. Now, I think that we have to make sure that we remember that whatever we see right now does not have a period at the end of it, as if that's the end, but that there's a comma after all these horror stories. Not periods. Because the temptation to be in a conspiracy of silence, to just stick our head in the sand, often reflects a disposition of hopelessness. And Christians are supposed to be people of hope. Why are we people of hope? Because we've read the back of the book. That's why. And if we've read the back of the book, we know that evil and injustice, all the myriad distortions that humans have perpetrated over the centuries, these things are on borrowed time. Or one way I like to think about it is that if you think about an hourglass, right? Ever since the resurrection, the hourglass has been set. And sands of the hourglass are going. And what we might see when we look at the difficulties with race, the difficulties with various kinds of inter-ethnic conflict, with all kinds of geopolitical difficulties, we might be looking at how much sand there still is, on the upper part of the hourglass. And when we look at the upper part of the hourglass, what we're thinking is, nothing's moving. We don't look down and see that the sands are in motion. And then eventually the sands are going to run out. But if our gaze is only up here, we can be tempted to be part of the conspiracy of silence. But if we think about the end of the story, I don't believe that we can do that. An important text, I think, is helpful for that, and the text that flows out of language about the resurrection is 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 58, which, after talking about the resurrection, about the fact that death will be vanquished, Paul then tells them, "Therefore, my dear brothers and sisters, stand firm, let nothing move you." Nothing. "Always give yourself fully to the work of the Lord, because you know that your labor in the Lord is not in vain." It's not empty. Now, of course, there's one tricky phrase in here that for some people, this is their, their ticket out of what we've been talking about. And that's that phrase, "the work of the Lord." Because, what do you mean, "work of the Lord," Paul? Oh, not this stuff. Well, there's only one problem. If I look in Romans, I think it is. This is one example. Let me find it. Where does he say that? Because Paul himself quotes the second grace commandment. And what? I'm thinking Romans 12, but it's not Romans 12, actually. I can't remember exactly right now. But the point is this. If Paul quotes Romans 12, Paul quotes the second grace commandment, love your neighbor as yourself, then it seems to me all the dimensions of love your neighbor as yourself are part of the work of the Lord. And even think about the end of, almost the end of the book of Galatians. Christians characterized by service. Right? Always abounding in the work of the Lord, especially to those who are of the house of the faith, but not only those who are of the household of faith. Especially, did you say Romans 12:9? All right, let me go back. This is what happens. Like you read something, right? And it's like, oh, it was right there, and I just read past it. One second, thank you. Yes. Hey, love must be sincere. Hate was evil. Clean was good. Yes, right. Share with God's people who are in need. Practice hospitality. Never be lacking zeal, etc. Well, it's all articulated there, yes. And then, just because I mentioned it, Galatians 6, at the beginning, verse 2, carry each other's burdens, and this way you fulfill the law of Christ. Then fast forward to verse 9. Let us not become weary in doing good, for at the proper time we will reap a harvest if we do not give up. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all people, especially to those who belong to the family of believers. So my point is that the work of the Lord, back to 1 Corinthians chapter 15, and I'm just noting these other texts, because sometimes people say, well, Paul didn't say, when he said work of the Lord in 1 Corinthians 15, he didn't say anything about social engagement, because all he meant was telling people about justification. Well, no, that's not what he was only talking about. Of course, that's part of what he's talking about. But he's talking about, one way to put it, love in action. Love of neighbor in action. What does love of neighbor in action mean when you have to deal with these difficult, complex issues? Well, it means lots of patience. Tremendous patience. Paul's telling us, keep at it. Why keep at it? Because you know the end of the story. It's not in vain. And this is why I think, you know, it's good for us to see successes that other people have. We need to see those. But the fact that we see a success somewhere doesn't mean that we have the same timeline that they had. Or that success over here will mirror what was over here. It's not just about something we can package and put into a formula. There's lots of revision, lots of recalibrations that have to happen with whatever we're doing. Why? Because every circumstance is different. And because every circumstance is different, you may have to make some mid-course corrections. That's the way it is. But regardless, we have to be people who stay at it. People who are unmoved, rather than people who are ready to go on vacation. So we have to ask, and this goes back to the question last night, well, what does it look like? Or what language are you going to use, Vince, to talk about what those things are? Okay, so here comes Dean. So we need to think about how the things that we do provide glimpses and previews of the kingdom that is to come in fullness. Not how, of course, we resolved every problem in the world ourselves. I mean, that'd be great. I mean, I would love that. Remember, I'm an idealist. So my fantasy is that, oh, wow, we resolve it all in an afternoon. But that's called naive, or that's called having a Messiah complex. And I'd rather be neither. So we have to think about what is our part. What is our action? Now here's the thing. This is really important. Asking the question, what is our part, is not a question to ask to give yourself an excuse to opt out. What's our part? Not that part. Okay, that's not what I mean. But what's our part in the face of those difficulties? And how do we begin considering what are some things to do to attend to these difficult problems? How do we model love of neighbor? How do we model the gospel in action? How do we provide previews of kingdom reality? And I say previews because, not because there isn't something that actually happens that might be a particular social change, let's say. But I'm saying even if that social change itself is a preview. Because I'm trying to avoid that language of course, we will bring in the kingdom. completely. Ourselves. Right? So that's why I'm using preview as part of my language here. But preview doesn't mean, in other words, you only talked about or you sent somebody a letter. I mean, it includes concrete actions. So it's worth asking yourself this question. One, how much, if at all, do I think about eschatology? How much do I think about the end of the story? And then, what place does the end of the story have in the way that I think about going about the Christian mission? And does my eschatology help me to be a helpful person? I mean, a hopeful person. Hopeful and then helpful. Or is my eschatology like a footnote? Well, it's nice to know that there's the back of the book, but we don't really talk about it. It's good to know, but it has zero bearing on the present. I think Paul would tell us it needs to have considerable bearing on the present, because if we are aware of how the story is going to end, we won't be those who lament and then go on vacation. We lament and we stay in the game. In my book that's coming out next May, as I was thinking about the last chapter, which is called Staying in the Game, actually, it's about perseverance, I use the term cruciform transformation, or phrase cruciform transformation, to talk about a sort of posture or a strategy or an approach to our engagement in life here. And the reason I use cruciform transformation is because if you're involved in trying to address these difficult things, you're just going to feel like you're suffering some of the time. You will at least have mental anguish, if not more. And, you know, I mean, it's as simple as the fact that people sometimes really have a hard time getting on the same page. And sometimes people have a hard time getting on the same page. Why? Well, because, I mean, have you ever been in a conversation with somebody and they were kind of upset about something? And there were things that you knew that you could talk about with this person, but really all they wanted to talk about was what they were upset about. And they kind of wanted to just stay there for a while. Well, what do you do in a situation like that, right? I mean, it's easy to say, you know what, I'm done. I'm out. Can't deal with this anymore. If you're going to deal with things related to issues of race and ethnicity, particularly, one thing you have to have is incredible patience. An incredible willingness to deal with the misunderstanding that is bound to occur, because it's going to happen. Why? Because when people start talking about various things, you might not always understand somebody's experience or their interpretation of their experience. And sometimes what people like to do, because people often have their ideas about this, instead of trying to understand someone else, what they do is they basically say, well, let me provide the interpretation for you of what your experience is. Okay, in fact, I will give you an example from Wheaton College. Wheaton College, we have a group on campus called Solidarity. They address issues of race and ethnicity and justice, etc. And sometimes there are students who will say, hey, the chapels you want to make sure you miss during the year are Solidarity chapels. Why? Well, because they like make you try to feel like you're guilty when you shouldn't feel guilty and stuff. All right, now that already tells me something, right? But there's one time when we had this thing called the forum wall where students sometimes say, hey, I need a ride here. Other times people write about particular issues. So some student wrote a letter, and in it he said, Solidarity brings up issues that don't exist or that aren't real. problems that we aren't really here on campus. Somebody underlined that and said, yeah, right. Now, I was ready to like set the forum wall on fire when I read that. Why? Well, because it's just interesting to me that anybody knows enough about everyone's experience on the Wheaton College campus that you can define what's a problem and what isn't. And you know every problem that's on campus. But it reflects someone deciding, I'll interpret for you what's a problem and what isn't. Because I know what's a problem and what isn't. Because I know everything about the world. That's what I'm doing. And a lot of times, this creates difficulty for people understanding each other. If someone's already decided that they already understand everything, someone else who wants to be understood, or they might eventually want to be understood, they might want to just vent a little bit first, and then they might get around to wanting to be understood, because that's what happens sometimes. The person vents, and the other person says, well, I'll tell you what the problem is. Well, instead of saying, say I don't get it if you don't get it. But saying I don't get it is the beginning of trying to learn to understand what the other person is talking about. And it doesn't necessarily mean you need to agree with everything about their interpretation of it, but why do they see things that way? Why do they see things that way? Why do they always regard X, Y, and Z, you know? I'll give you an example, for example. Like I don't tend to get nervous. I tend to think about the police being like to protect and serve, generally, right? But I have a friend. He's actually the pastor of a successful interracial church in Columbia, Maryland. When he was he's about 6'3", African-American guy. When he was, getting his master's degree, he did an internship at Willow Creek Community Church. So he's driving out from Chicago to Barrington in his rusty Honda Civic, Honda Accord. On his first day, right, he was pulled over 4 times. And every time they said, you look like someone that we had heard about or are looking for. So it happened, I think, twice before he got there the first time. Once on his lunch break, and I think once on the way home. That's his first day in Barrington, Illinois. A very, very cozy, nice, very wealthy area. And the only reason I mentioned that is that, I think maybe once somebody might have possibly thought that I might have been pulled over for that, even though I had, like, my friend John Fia, who's the head of history at Messiah College now. He's like a 6'7" white guy. So I could have just been pulled over for driving while black, you know, because I got a big white guy in the car with me. But the only possibility, because they said, oh, your car fits the description of a car that we had heard. Right? That was in Highland Park, Illinois. But generally, I haven't ever been pulled over and felt like somebody is, saying, well, you're someone we were looking for, right? But I have colleagues at Wheaton College who are darker than me, who've had that happen to them in the city of Wheaton. One of whom even was pulled over for allegedly driving, using a cell phone in a non-cell phone area. And so the thing the cop didn't reckon on was that he was going to show up at the traffic court with his cell phone bill, which showed that he didn't have his cell phone on when he was pulled over. So the ticket was dismissed, right? That's because he knows how to, what kinds of things you do, right? But the point is, and he's a guy who's pretty, his blood is pretty dark. And he's not like a radical or whatever, but the reason he told that story to people is because a lot of people don't believe those things happen. But if you're a person who gets pulled over 4 times in one day, do you think you might think about the police a little differently than somebody else? Right? But you have to understand and inhabit that person's experience in order to be able to say, okay, that's not my experience. Man, help me understand how you're seeing things. And I mean, again, it's just one example, but there's got to be the willingness to be patient and have those kinds of conversations. And have conversations where you just deal with people's anger and their frustration. And even if sometimes they sound like conspiracy theorists, because some people do, you know, you got to deal with all that. But you don't then say, okay, so the way forward is to just either just buy everything. I mean, you talk about it. And when you talk about it, you contend with lots and lots of misunderstanding, or the risk of that, because that just goes with the territory. Patience, the ability to deal with misunderstanding, but then a commitment to say, how do we take the first step forward? And then another step, and then another step, and then another step. And when you're thinking about this, and I think particularly if we're thinking about it in terms of framed by eschatology, we have to be committed to taking a very long view. A vision where the view is way, 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 way down there where the end is. Not right here, but way down there. And how am I starting the path towards this long, long journey with the culmination way down there? How am I participating in that, rather than how am I checking out because it's just too hard? Checking out because it's just too hard, I don't think is an option. I think if we're committed to the mission of the church, a mission that includes a commitment to neighbor love, a holistic expression of kingdom witness, we can't bench ourselves. But we have to become people of tremendous patience, who practice lament, who are inspired by the fact that there's an end that comes that will make everything glorious. And because we know that's going to happen, we're able to just stay in the fray. And if we stay in the fray, then what does that mean that others will see? They may not see it initially, but they may see it over time. What will they see then? What will they begin to say about us? I mean, they might begin to say, wow, they actually are taking these things seriously. They're actually modeling something different. And it's something that won't make sense to people. Because what makes sense to most people is just kind of hang out with your own kind, take your toys and go home, or to check out when it gets too hard. Especially in a society that is so oriented to comfort. But Christians, I believe, should be an alternative to that. So you have to maintain the vision. Maintain the vision and resist checking out. You know? Or resist refusing to check in to begin with. If you're to check in and stay in. I mean, please understand. I mean, there are times where I want to say to people, would you just say talk about something else? Can we like pay attention to something else? Can we talk about other stories? But I have to ask myself, at least some of the time, okay, man, why are they so bent? Why do they keep talking about this? I have to do both. And I have to also say, okay, look at the truth of what's going on here. And then practice lament and don't go to the bench. I've got to do it all the time. It's not easy. But just because it's not easy doesn't mean that really it's optional for us as God's people. All right, questions. He says that he hears the fan. Yes, ma'am.
Just a comment. When you were speaking about getting stuck in the mud.
Yes.
You need a push. You need
yes.
somebody to be praying for you.
Yes.
And I don't think we're praying. We don't know who's encountering difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
We aren't praying for them because sometimes we don't know.
Yes.
Or we're just neglecting.
Yes, yes, yes. And, no, and I think that's very important to note because, though I'm talking about, you know, this all this action, prayer is an important action. And, of course, lament, this practice of lament is one expression of prayer, but there's also even having all these problems on our radar and being willing to pray about them. Yes, absolutely. So thank you for mentioning that. Yes. Yes. He's a mixed race president, but yes.
What's that?
He's a mixed race president.
Yes.
Who's literally an African American. Because his dad's from Kenya and his mom's white. Kansas. So he's not really a black president, in my view. Anyway, I'm sorry. He's not. Well, no, because people do. It depends on what your definition of black is. I just say he's literally African American, but he doesn't come through the trajectory of. It's not like when Jesse Jackson ran for president. You know, I mean, don't get me wrong, he's better than Jesse Jackson, but. I would push you on that for this reason. First of all, a lot of African Americans feel like Obama's done like this much for typical African American problems. They probably feel, well, you've done more for homosexuals than you've done for African Americans. So I think there's certainly a lot of people who think he hasn't, quote unquote, attended to his people. But here's the question. Well, who are his people? The reason I say that is because, I mean, you've got this guy whose mom's a white lady from Kansas, who's Harvard educated, who, his trajectory is unique. But also, he never ran as a black candidate. He ran as an American candidate. So that's how he's identified himself, not as a black president. So I think he has been, to some people, a disappointment. Although other people argue, they think that because there are people who are like, look, you look like you're black to me, so that's just the label I'm going to give you, no matter that you're really African American, right, in terms of, you know, heritage. I do believe he's an American citizen, okay, so let me just qualify that. I just think that's ridiculous, the whole birther thing. But nonetheless, like my relatives, they think that the Republicans opposing him is in part tied to his complexion, the level of opposition. I think it coincides with the greater polarization that's happened ideologically in the last decade, because you saw it happening with Bush. I mean, the way that like lots of Democrats talked about Bush in a very, very condescending way, like essentially thinking, how could this idiot ever get elected, right? Nobody's calling Obama stupid because the guy's really smart. Right, so professor in chief and all these things that people call him. But there are people who think that, like, when the senator or representative from South Carolina said, you lied during a, you know, the only reason that he did that is because he doesn't respect somebody who's not white. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not. You know, I mean, I think that coincides with the ideological thing. But for some people, I mean, that could be part of it. I mean, would that have happened even if it had been Hillary? You know, maybe not. You know, so, but that's one of the things we can't tell, because you really have to know inside the mind of the person that did it. But I don't think that we have really talked about it as much. I think what's made people talk about it more, honestly, is things like the Zimmerman, Trayvon Martin, you know, because it gets all drawn out. And also because the 24/7 news cycle is voracious. You've got to have content constantly, right? So we don't have news just three hours a day now. We have news 24 hours a day. Okay, well, how many times can you tell the same story? And if you tell the same story, you got to keep adding to it. You got to keep having a different angle to it. So what gets ratings? So all those things play a role, I think. So that magnifies stories that will get people talking and get ratings, and you can bring pundits in to argue, you know, with each other, and to not often be substantial. I think, it's hard to be really substantial when somebody has 5 minutes. But those types of things, I think, put it more on the radar. It's almost like incidental that Obama is, you know, who he is ethnically, because. If you look at like the majority of the things he's done, he hasn't primarily majored on like quote unquote elevating his people, as some people think. So in fact, a lot of people think he's left behind minorities and poor people, and wound up being more militaristic than they thought, and more friendly to corporate interests than they thought. Yeah.
This polarization.
Yep.
It seems like there's more conversation about this, and the internet also
mm-hmm.
involved. Mm-hmm. I guess my question to you is, when do you, in terms of your understanding, when do you talk about it, and when do you just seek to overcome it by your action?
By doing something, right? Well, I guess here's the thing, right? You said, like, I think. I'm not sure more people really are talking about it. I think the same people talk about it with each other. They talk about it more loudly. And there are other people who still don't talk about it, except to say we talk about it too much. So I think that's more of what happens than people who aren't talking about it are kind of feeling like, well, we've got to talk about these things. I think more of that happens. Yeah.
You're really seeing proclamations as an important part of that.
A proclamation is a dimension of it, but I'm thinking more honestly of beyond proclamation. Now what? Okay, you proclaim. Okay. So what kinds of relationships are happening? What kinds of, you know, what people who are the ones that are involved in policy making, etc., how many people are thinking about being involved in policy, you know, way down the road at the early stages of developing policy, a policy that may not, you know, become something that gets passed for like 5 or 6 years? Because I think a lot of times what's happened with evangelical political action, let's say, is, I mean, it's been about like, you know, politics is like living next door to the fire station, right? I mean, an alarm goes off, you send out the fire, you know, the fire truck, and you try to address the crisis, and then you go back into the fire station. But you don't. But in terms of like being like a gardener who is sowing seeds until, you know, and doing all the work, you know, and eventually you get some, you know, some fruit. That's not the way that most people think about being involved in the political process. I mean, it's like, here's a crisis. We should care about that crisis. Try to get some legislation passed, or call your congressman about this, or try to get this person elected. But in terms of talking about a range of policies, attending to lots of, you know, and then, and you're talking about policies, I mean, at the early stage, And it's almost like you're thinking about, okay, we want a society that's like whatever, you know, better public schooling, let's say. Okay, so what is going on in terms of thinking about schooling that's not just thinking about crisis management, but thinking constructively in terms of policy? I mean, that's not how people tend to talk about it. We talk about crisis. Crisis make better news. And crises also raise more money. So I'm talking about being willing to do this sort of nitty gritty type of stuff is very, very important. And I think, but that's not, as exciting. You'll get ratings as much for that, right? Because some people say, well, that's kind of like watching paint dry. Well, sometimes that policy making, I think, is like that. But those are the kinds of things that have to happen. Politically speaking. And I think, is there a place for, prophetic rhetoric, for protests, etc.? Yes. But protests don't create policies. Protests identify things, and you hope that there are particular actions or particular things that might get set in motion. But still, if something is set in motion, there's got to be a process, this culminates in something. So protest is one form of action, but what are other kinds of actions? Various ways that people can be involved. I mean, for some people, I think it could be as simple as what can you do to support parents in poorer communities? By the way, and this includes, and really, this isn't just about minorities. This is like, rural Appalachia. Okay, how do you have better education in rural Appalachia? How do you have parents, how do you encourage parents to think about showing up for parent-teacher conferences? Right, I get an email from the school, hey, parent-teacher conferences are coming up, schedule them, etc. I go schedule them, or my wife schedules them. I just encountered someone who said, it's interesting that someone who I think they came, if I remember, she encountered some children who came from, it was either Mexico or another country close to it. And the mom, it was in Northern Virginia actually. The mom was just happy that their kids could go to school without being in danger. But the mom didn't think about parent-teacher conferences. I mean, I take parent-teacher conferences for granted, or parental involvement as an option that I have. Those parents aren't thinking about that. How do you help those people think about those dimensions of, they're happy that their kids can get an education, but how do you help people say, well, it can be more than your kid just getting an education? There's all these other things around your kid getting an education where they're getting an education bigger than what you're actually envisioning. Well, until my friend told me about this, it didn't occur to me that there might be kids of immigrant families or whatever, their kids go to school. The parents are just glad the kids go to school. They're not thinking about all these other supportive things that can facilitate the flourishing of that child. And I take it for granted. So how are we thinking about, the ways that those kinds of supports can happen, from non-government types of ways, other social groups can help with that. So it's all that type of stuff that I think is really important. But it's harder to get that stuff on the radar because it's not as pyrotechnic. Yes, whose name I have not mentioned, but of course I'm always happy to mention his name.
I read the biography recently.
Jim Bratt's biography? Yeah, okay.
Very talented book, but
he was.
To see in his day, start the Plato Party.
Yeah. Well, he helped start it, yes. Yeah.
And certainly entered politics, became prime minister, and really invested in time in the country. But
Yeah.
And I'm just curious to see, in a larger context that we've been talking about here, is that is that something that would be helpful in the political process where we're so bipolar in our credit form?
Right.
Everybody, you get it this or that. And it's like you're asking for people to be at least the third option. There's probably four or five other options we can talk about, but just in terms of trying to accomplish things, but it makes sense
to have a third party?
A third party, a fourth party, or something. I mean,
yes.
A huge undertaking, but.
I wish, yeah. I think if we had a third or fourth party that was an actual third or fourth party that contended with the Democratic and Republican machines, that would be very helpful. Because I think it would get to the fact that there's more than two options. Because I think most people recognize that there's more than two options or more than two ways to think about the issues that they care about. And there are other parties, but most of them are really small, and you don't have. I mean, you have very, very few people in Congress that are not either Democrat or Republican. You have very few that are literally independent, or that are. I don't think there's maybe one person is that. Like, well, I think the person that was an actual socialist, I think. But I think they still might have been a Democrat or something, right? But because yeah, there's a socialist party, so we have those. But I mean, I think a legitimate contending third party, you almost need something like what happened when Perot ran for president, really. But the thing was that you know he had so much money, and he was able to galvanize enough support. But the reason he could do that was because he was his own machine.
About Kyler when he was not afraid to, like his party, correct me if I'm wrong, was a composed of Christians, sort of Protestants.
It was, yes.
Catholics.
Well, the coalition was Protestant and Catholics, yes. Yes.
The coalition, you know, and that's yes. Something that Christians sometimes think about, like all or none.
Yes. Well, again, because all or none, make, you know, you can raise more money that way, for one thing. I mean, seriously, if I send you something in the mail about these threats to us, people are, you know, they're reaching for their checkbook, right? If I say, well, it's really more complicated, actually. The people are like, I was grabbing for it, but then you lost me. Why? Well, because I just want to write a check, you know. What happened with Kuiper, he had to have a coalition. It's the only way he became prime minister. And there are people who've been involved in politics for a long time that recognize you have to work with people in order to get things done. But what has been rewarded for probably the last decade is the illusion of ideological purity. And that with ideological purity, of course, you go to Congress and you'll get things done. And of course, well, you're getting people spinning their wheels politically. You know, nothing's happening. But that's why Congress has a lower rating than the president. Because people, I mean, but it's a weird thing. There are people who say you have to have ideological purity on both sides, and in many races, and very little, has gotten done, and people are very frustrated about it. But then they keep voting in. Well, you know, the people who wind up getting voted in, depending upon who actually goes to the polls, because we wind up taking, I think, voting for granted mostly in the United States. I mean, think about what happened in Scotland with the referendum. The percentage of people that showed up to vote about whether to secede or not, it's huge. I think it was like 90%. It would be amazing for us to get a 90% turnout in the United States. I mean, a lot of times, you know, you have something, and after a while, we just don't take advantage of what we have. All right, I think this is just humans just do this. So that's also part of it is people actually being willing to care enough. In fact, I remember I either in the 2004 election or the 2008 election, there was this campaign about getting young people out, and it was like vote or die. Right, so it was like, you know, a vote or die. It was just a way to talk to get people engaged. And I remember one of the news people saying when the demographics were coming out of who voted and who didn't, she goes, "Well, I guess there'd be young people laying all over the place because of the percentage of young people that didn't vote." But I think also some of that also has to do with the fact that when we think about electing people, the influence of style over substance and my ability to mesmerize, etc., that a lot of times is what people are trying to be drawn by. They want to be inspired by someone. But inspiration alone doesn't make policy. So I'm not saying we can't ever have a third party, we won't, but I think it will take, you have to have, I think, the commitment of a lot of people, and with the way that the system is right now, including some people that are really wealthy, to back people and to identify candidates, and then you introduce these people into it, and they actually have something to say that is different from the other parties. But that's a challenging thing to do, which doesn't mean it shouldn't be done, but it's hard. Yes.
I have a question from
the That's fine. A question from the first session today. Yes.
I was going to ask about the statement that letting sometimes more or less people go to their own destruction from their own sin.
Yes.
And I realize that is used many times as an excuse in the wrong way.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering what you think about that and how that fits besides the excuse.
Sure. So there's definitely a number of places where Scripture talks about if people head down a particular path, sometimes the thing for us to do is just get out of the way because they're about to go slam into a wall, and there's nothing you can do about it. I think it's why we don't get to opt out of discernment, like I said last night. So we may see that there are people who are in difficult circumstances or who've developed pathological ways of operating, and they don't really want to be helped. And there's some people, I mean, they sort of love being pathological. In those circumstances, there may not be anything we can do in terms of hands-on, but we can still pray for those people. Because the fact is, we don't know, I don't think that we have a good enough capacity to discern ourselves exactly when somebody's crossed that threshold to where they, of course, are just going to some path of destruction. I don't think that we can see that clearly. There are obviously people we can say it looks like if they may stay on this path, it's just ugly. But I think it's hard for us I don't think we know when someone is beyond repair. I think that's a judgment call that I think is very, very hard for any of us to make.
That would be where the lament would come in.
Lament would definitely come in there.
I mean,
lament, but also asking God to to do things. I mean, one thing we need to ask ourselves sometimes is, I mean, do we really believe God's powerful? Don't we? And that God might actually do something, as opposed to just saying, "Oh, you know, it's a pity," and then we just sigh and go about our business. So,
if it was one of our family members or our children, we would throw ourselves in front of them to, you know, as they're going down the street.
In many cases, people would, yes. Yes.
I mean, you would do that, but it's easier when it's somebody that really doesn't, you know, your heart's not
yes.
with them.
It's easier to be dismissive of those that we find ourselves less inclined to care about.
Right.
Or we're just less familiar with them. And sometimes it's just because they're not on our radar. Other times it's because somehow we've been formed in a way to have a kind of animosity towards them. I mean, I think that happens with, like, for a lot of people, with people from the Middle East right now in the United States, right? Okay, someone from the Middle East. Well, I mean, what do we know about, like, most people in the Middle East? Not a whole lot. So I think to assume, of course, well, most people in the Middle East, what do they want to do? They all want to be suicide bombers. I don't think so.
I think it's a reminder to try to not give up on.
Yes.
It allows you to keep plodding forward.
Yes. Yes.
You can maybe even picture them as, what would I do if this was...
Yes.
I cared.
Yes.
Really cared about.
Yes, exactly. I think sometimes one thing that happened for me once was when I was in, between college and seminary, I would sometimes see, when I was driving home, I'd see a guy who had to be over 50. He was homeless, and he'd be pushing a shopping cart. And one day it occurred to me. But this is like, I've seen the guy many times, and I've seen other homeless people before, so I don't know what happened. Maybe it's the hand of providence. It occurred to me, wait a minute, that guy has a mother and father, or had a mother and father, and he might be somebody's, you know, he might have a sister or a brother somewhere. How do you get there? You know, I mean, and it could be all because of choices he made. But the fact is that when I start thinking about somebody being someone's son, someone's sibling, all of a sudden, I mean, they start becoming a lot more human all of a sudden. They're not just a one or two dimensional object. And just like you're saying, if we're thinking about what if this was one of my family members? What would be my disposition then? Well, I think that does help us. And actually, if we think about it from a Christian point of view, if we're talking about people in the church, they are our brothers and sisters. But are we really taking that seriously? Oh, wow. Okay. The ball of wax question is coming. All right.
So this is a great perspective that you've given to us. I'm very much a one kingdom guy. So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
One kingdom. Sorry.
Christ is king of all this. What our tendency is, as humans, is to swing in a pendulum. And so I've read some of David Van Drunen's stuff when he speaks of some of the weaknesses of a one kingdom perspective. I think sometimes we can be so supportive of a perspective that we lose sight of the weaknesses of it. And yesterday you mentioned and Van Drunen mentions this, that with this perspective, it automatically reduces the importance of the church. What other weaknesses would you say there are that we need to be aware of, pitfalls, mm-hmm. we need to make sure that we're not swinging to another extreme
right.
and falling into
Right. Well, I guess the first thing I would say is, I mean, if we talk about the identity of a Christian and the identity of mission, it's hard for me to take those seriously and not take church seriously. But if we're going to take church seriously, we need to talk about that as well, right? So we need to recognize that anytime you emphasize something, or you're emphasizing something in a particular moment, you're choosing not to emphasize or highlight other things. The fact of not emphasizing or highlighting other things isn't permission to neglect those things. A massive occupational hazard if you're a Kuiperian is to only be a certain kind of Kuiperian, only an antithesis Kuiperian, so you're only thinking about Christians as distinctive social groupings, etc., or only a common grace Kuiperian, where you're thinking about the permission we have to participate in the world, and you're very excited about our participation in the world, but then you just marginalize. You marginalize personal piety, you marginalize the life of the church, etc., even though Kuiper did none of those. So, but those are definitely occupational hazards of it. But it's why we have to. Well, it's another reason why you can't turn the discernment hat off. You've got to be asking about, what blind spots might I have? What weaknesses might there be in the way that I'm talking about this? What liabilities might there be if I only do X and don't do Y? How do I emphasize X but make sure that I'm acknowledging Y? So we have to have if you think about the kind of radar thing that you see that turns from side to side, we kind of have to have that kind of perspective where our radar is always on, rotating from side to side, as opposed to just fixed in one direction. Because otherwise, it's just easy to be myopic. I mean, you can only talk about race. You can only talk about politics. You can only talk about culture. You can only talk about sacraments. There's all kinds of things we have to give attention to. And some people, in terms of what their actual ministries will be, what the kind of way that they're living out holistic mission, it may be in one area. But because some people are in one area, it doesn't mean everybody has to be in that area. I mean, there are lots of needs that can be articulated as if this is the only need that there is in the world. No, there's many needs. Or your need could just be about clean water. Okay, that's a gigantic problem worldwide. Literacy, still a big problem worldwide. And you can spend all your time on that. But that doesn't mean everybody needs to spend their time on literacy. But somebody needs to be there. But other people need to recognize, well, there's somewhere else. I need to invest my time in particular area or areas, etc. So we have to have vigilance about the gifts and liabilities of our perspective, because we're constantly in an act of refinement, I think. Because hopefully we're seeing more and more clearly, but we still see through a glass darkly. And because we do, we have to keep working and sharpening our vision.